Please be seated.
And I am Bill Meyer, and I'll be your presiding justice this afternoon. And I introduce to you all, I'm sure you know, but Justice Gardner on my right, Justice Gabriel on my left, we're your panel for the first case today. And we have one case and then a panel change. And so we'll take a short recess after we finish the first case and then go on with our docket after that. So if you'll please call the first case. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Meyer, Gardner, and Gabriel, thank you for the courtesies extended to me in allowing me to file my reply brief one day late, and for the courtesies extended to preserve the estate during this litigation, and for granting us oral argument. We understand those are discretionary, and we thank you. If I was representing Flagstar Bank, the holder of the first lien on the house, Exhibit 6 and 7, Exhibit 15, the 24, the promissory note, you would be affirming a summary judgment in favor of Flagstar Bank. You would be affirming the award of attorney's fees at paragraph 24 of the deeds of trust. You would be affirming the legal fees as set out in paragraph 6C of the promissory note, exhibit 24. Instead, what you're here is a case involving the equitable jurisdiction of the courts in Texas. And that was the dilemma that was facing our judge below. On the one hand, he was being asked to approve an agreed-to divorce. All the elements of the divorce were agreed to, submitted to the court pursuant to a Rule 11 agreement, and yet we had an outside intervener that was seeking equitable subrogation and lien on the house. We intervened in the case only because in late 2011, the house was being sold, a receivership motion was filed, and it was before Judge Catterton to sell the house, and no provision made to repay Dan Dees. The dilemma that Judge Catterton had was, on the one hand, how does he let this divorce go forward, let the people work it out, and on the other hand, give us some balance and equity for a party that loaned $300,000 in October 2010 to a couple that were his family. Dan Dees has no other brother, no sisters, no other nephews or nieces. This is his family. He loaned them the money. He trusted them. He knew the money was going to be used to pay off the mortgage. And the mortgage was paid in October 2010. And that's where we asked this court and Judge Catterton to leave the parties. As of October 2010, when they received the money to pay off the $200,000 mortgage, the home improvements, the transportation, which we submit to you, housing and transportation are necessaries in this day. Judge Catterton faced with the dilemma of what to do, how to best allow the families to get on with their lives. And when we finally had our trial, which was delayed because of the David Vernon Dees' other problems, they had agreed to everything in the divorce except how to repay Dan Dees. We took Sarah's deposition. She said, I have no ability to repay this mortgage. So the latest motion for receivership was granted by Judge Catterton after the divorce. And the only thing before Judge Catterton was whether or not Dan Dees is going to be repaid out of the proceeds of the house, and that's why we brought this appeal. We believe that under the doctrine of equitable subrogation, what Texas courts do, and it's a Texas court-created concept, is protect against unjust enrichment. If Mrs. Dees and David Vernon Dees had been making the monthly payments since October 2010, that would be almost, to this point in time, $66,000 last March, almost $90,000 as of now of unjust enrichment. They've had the free use of that monthly payment, $2,300 a month, not had to repay it to anybody. So when they used our money and everybody agreed to it, requests for admissions are before the court. Those are judicial admissions. The inventory is before the court, admitting that the money was used to pay off the mortgage, the $200,000 mortgage to Flagstar Bank. But Mrs. Dees now no longer wants to repay Dan Dees out of the proceeds, and that's why we're here. The equitable subrogation is as of October 2010. What Dandies did in October 2010 is what you're looking at, and whether or not you're going to allow us the doctrine of equitable subrogation, the standards for equitable subrogation, and that's why we argued this with Judge Catterton, is set out in your decision, Hewland versus Hamilton. It is so clear that you had a friend, a neighbor, paying his six friend mortgage. He paid the ad valorem taxes. And then when she died, the kids didn't want to pay him back. And this court upheld the concept of equitable subrogation to that friend, that neighbor. And we're more than a friend and neighbor. We're the relative of this family. And so what we are asking simply is to prevent now what's called unjust enrichment, because David and Sarah Dees have not had to make a monthly payment since October 2010, $2,300 a month. They've had no obligation to move from the premises. We've not pressed them. We've not asked them to move. In fact, the sequence of events are as follows. They file the motion for receivership. We file our petition and intervention. And then in January, we opposed it successfully, the receivership. And then we filed an amended petition, intervention, and a motion for summary judgment. We began in December after we filed the intervention, and in March trying to settle this case. At one point, and it's before you now, Mr. Wilson, over objection, had it admitted to evidence, exhibits 58, 59. We tried to settle this case by offering Mrs. Dees $35,000, exhibit 58 and 59, and Mr. Wilson $10,000, free and clear, no strings attached. So we tried to settle this case, and after we couldn't settle it, then we set our motion for summary judgment down for hearing. We filed the motion for summary judgment so that Judge Catterton would have before him a little-known concept, equitable subrogation, because equitable subrogation is from my background. Two lenders, two banks, a junior lender is out there. Property goes into foreclosure because the debtor can't make his payments. The junior lien holder is out there saying, oh, my God, I'm about to lose my collateral, I'm about to lose my position. So the junior lien holder pays the first lien holder to protect themselves. And that's mostly the cases that you see is called equitable subrogation. For whatever reason, the two lending institutions don't make an assignment of lien. So subrogation is an equitable remedy that this court has fashioned so eloquently in Hewland versus Hamilton. And that's what we argued to Judge Catterton. We traced our money into the homestead. It's in the request for admissions. It's in the interrogatories. It's in the inventory, the exhibits before you. There's no question that the money was used and what it was used for in that three-month period, October through December 2010. We submit that's where the courts should leave the parties as of that date. There is nothing in the record or in the reply brief, nothing in the record or in the reply brief that shows any facts to support that the doctrine of equitable subrogation should not be applied, that conclusion of law. There is nothing in the record that Dandies did, no inequitable conduct that Dandies did in the trial record before you, why Judge Catterton did not say that the money used, Dandies' money used for the house mortgage and for transportation, for home improvements to the bathroom and the pool, which Mrs. D said enhanced the property when she's trying to sell it now. There's nothing in that record to support the finding that Dan Dees is a volunteer and that this money was not used for necessaries. Respectfully reserve the balance of her time.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much of the amount loaned or given, whatever, by Dan to Mr. and Mrs. Dees was for payment of the mortgage or went for payment of the mortgage?
$302,300 total in October. $201,000 was for the mortgage alone.
$201,000.
Yes,
okay.
Ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. Any other questions? We reserve the balance of our time. Thank you for your courtesy.
I do have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Fishman, in the facts of this case, there's no assignment nor transfer nor anything. Not even direct connection between Mr. Dandies and the mortgage company.
That's correct.
And it appears from reading the Hewland and Hamilton case that there was a difference there in that Mr. Hamilton paid directly to the mortgage company the balance and therefore stepped into the shoes of the mortgage company in its direct contact with them.
So that was argued by the appellees, Your Honor, and I argued back, that's a distinction without a difference, because everyone admitted in the interrogatories, the request for admissions, and in testimony, Dandy's money was used to pay the $201,000 mortgage.
And I've read the record, and I understand that's correct, and I've seen the record in terms of what Ms. D said, and she really equivocated some about that. I guess that's a word I would use in reading the record. But she never was pinned down to say that she did agree. She simply acknowledged that she knew the money was being obtained by David from his brother Dan, but that she didn't ever agree to it. And in fact, her testimony was that she said she let David know that she was opposed to it.
Well, your recollection is exactly correct, but that was what's before the trial court in Exhibit 16 and 17. She wrote the checks. She signed checks. It's not a matter of one person dominating another. She wrote the checks to pay for the bathroom, the remodeling, utilities, the credit card bills. She wrote those checks. That's why we have Exhibit 16 and 17. So it wasn't a situation where one spouse dominates, writes all the bills, pays all the bills, writes all the checks, and the other one just sits back. So this was a community obligation. She didn't have to spend the money. But the benefit, that's the unjust enrichment. The benefit, just like in Hewlin versus Hamilton, there was no assignment of lien. Mr. David, Joe Hamilton, paid the mortgage of his friend Donna.
Right.
And didn't get an assignment of lien.
I understand there wasn't an assignment in the sense of what would go on in a business transaction like you were talking about a moment ago from a second lien holder who's paying the first. You're sure going to want an assignment. But that didn't happen in either the Hewlin case nor in your case.
Correct.
And I'm just troubled a little by reading the record and seeing that the money transferred came by wire transfer into the account that was the joint account of David and Sarah.
Yes, Your Honor.
When that came in as a wire transfer, it simply went into the account and was held there for a few days, and I can't tell exactly when the mortgage was paid as to what date. I think it's some testimony about that later on, but at least it was within about 3 weeks, within 2 to 3 weeks from the October 10th transfer of the $302,000, that the $201,000 was paid to Flagship.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
But at the same time, the money, as far as Dan Dees was concerned, was transferred into the bank account of the two people, as opposed to being paid directly to the bank.
Dan treated Sarah and David as his brother and sister. They were his family. They are his family.
Well, the circumstance involving the homestead, it's pounded into all of us from the time we take property in law school, that you have certain things you have to do in Texas whenever you've got a homestead that's looked upon as a collateral for an advance money. We have some period of time here between when the money was being put into the bank account by wire transfer and then there was actually a payment made with no written. I mean, the equitable subrogation doctrine ought to get us past this business of, well, you got to go take a separate acknowledgement, all the things we used to have to be concerned about in terms of mortgages.
Pre-1969, yes,
Your Honor. Pre-1969. But at any rate, I'm struggling a bit with how to balance the Hewlin case decision. And that's a very well-written opinion by Honorable Justice Gardner, who's sitting to my right.
What a lucky person I am to have found to land in this court with Justice Gardner and before Judge Catterton. All kind people trying to do what's right. And that was the dilemma that Judge Catterton had, how to balance all those things. And so if they had made the mortgage payments to Dan Dees, they would have made $2,300 worth of mortgage payments now, 39 payments since then, since October 2010. So that's the unjust enrichment. If they sold the house and repaid him the $201,000, we never asked for foreclosure, eviction. We tried to settle this every which way we could. I don't know what more we could do to try to help these people, help his brother and sister.
All right, sir. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you for your courtesy, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Fishman.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Your Honors, I am keeping my cell phone up here solely for the purpose of being able to keep time in this case, if I might do so.
Are you expecting a call?
I certainly hope not. This case presents the issue of whether or not to abrogate the provisions of the Texas Constitution that prohibit the placement of a lien against a homestead unless it's for the five circumstances that have been enumerated under the statute. In this case, we have the appellant, and the appellant transferred $302,300 to the account of the appellees. That was on October the 20th. On November the 11th, the appellees paid $201,268 to discharge unaccelerated mortgage debt. The appellant would like to have the position that this is going to create an...
I'm sorry. I usually leave that in my chambers, and I'm very sorry. Honest, would you come take this and put it in my chambers?
Take care of it.
The appellant would like to take the position that this is going to somehow create an equitable lien against the marital homestead, and I would assert that there is no authority for his position. The facts in this case are very limited, very minimal. The parties were married August the 7th, 1993. Ultimately, they had four children. On September the 2nd, 2011, Sarah Dees filed her petition for divorce and also her application for a protective order. The protective order was ultimately granted, and David Dees was incarcerated on a felony sexual assault conviction, where he remains incarcerated. Prior to the time he was incarcerated, he went to live with his brother, the appellant, Dan Dees, in Katy, Texas. Dan Dees intervened in this matter on November the 2nd of 2011, seeking, number one, repayment of two transfers, $15,000 made in June of 2008, as well as the $302,300, which had been wire transferred October the 20th of 2010. And he also sought the equitable lien against the residents in this matter. There are two facts that I think, in addition, are incredibly important and central to this case. Number one, there are no documents at all evidencing either a debt or a lien from Dan Dees to the appellees. The other fact that I think is incredibly important in this case is that at no time was there any communication, as admitted by the appellant, Dan Dees, between him and Sarah Dees concerning either the $15,000 transfer or the $302,000 transfer. I believe that Mr. Fishman had stated that she had agreed to it. There is nothing in the record to indicate that she agreed to it. She had opposed it, and she never communicated with Dan Dees concerning either of the two transfers. In any event, the trial court granted a judgment for the $317,300 being the two transfers and denied the lien against the homestead. Appellant appealed, and we find ourselves here today. The first point of error that was assigned by the appellant, whether or not it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to grant the equitable subrogation. I believe indeed that the trial court was correct in determining that there was no lien for equitable subrogation. And under the doctrine of equitable subrogation, there are circumstances where it's appropriate. If the third party is going to pay the debt of the debtor, then he may be equitably subrogated to the creditor's rights. And the purpose is to prevent unjust enrichment. But you don't look at unjust enrichment to see where it's going into the future, but rather at the time of the transaction. And at the time of the transaction, we have the fact in the record that states that Sarah Dees had no communication with the appellant, so she didn't know whether she was not able to be in a situation to be unjustly enriched. There was no opportunity for fraud, no opportunity for duress, and no opportunity to take undue advantage of the appellant.
Let me ask you a question, Ms. Rowland. The record is replete with testimony by Sarah Dees that she helped to spend the money by writing checks.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that the difference in the $302,000 and the $201,000 payoff to the mortgage was spent on things that she was interested in and wanted to obtain or was a part in the obtaining and even in the writing of the checks. So how do we get around some element of unjust enrichment if she now is entitled to have the house sold without paying them any money to Dan Dees when she used the money and knew that it had come from him when she was using it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And my response to that is that in addition to the unjust enrichment, you also have two additional requirements. Number one, there has to be a payment of a debt upon which the debtor is primarily liable. And number two, the payment is going to have to be made involuntarily, or the payment may not be made voluntarily. And in the Hewlin case is where you reach that issue of whether or not there is going to be that voluntary involuntariness. And in Hewlin, it was determined that there was an issue of whether or not the payment was for necessities, whether or not the payment was being made on behalf of a person who was not able to make the payment. And in this case, that is absolutely true, Your Honor. Payments were not being made for necessities. There was no necessity for an entire unaccelerated principal mortgage payment to be made. That payment had been current. The record reflects that the debt for the mortgage had never been accelerated. The only amount that was due was the $2,380 that it was being paid monthly. The $201,268 for the mortgage balance wasn't due. It wasn't a necessity. And the second portion of it, she did make those payments. A drag racing car was purchased, a Corvette was purchased, a 2008 Chevy Tahoe was purchased when the parties had vehicles that were in great running condition. So she paid for a portion, and she had cosmetic surgery, a breast enlargement. She used the money for items, and he used the money for items that were not necessities. And I think that this is absolutely in opposite to Hewlin, where there was a single payment made to a mortgage company for $80,000. This isn't the same situation.
But as to the payment, paying off the house here and paying off the house in Hewlin, those elements are the same. It's over and above what was paid on the house that sounds like it was not for necessaries.
In addition to the necessary item, you also have, though, in Hewlin, an individual who was unable to make her payments. That's not the situation under our facts. Under our facts, looking at the exhibits, actually, of the appellant, we determine that prior to the $302,000 transfer, these parties had in excess of almost $100,000 available to them. It's not the portrait of a family in need. They had $15,000 available in their savings account. They had $7,700 in a checking account on October the 19th. The transfer hit October the 20th. There was a check for $9,400 that the husband had, bringing us to $32,000. They had an additional $45,000 to $50,000 in a 401k, bringing us up to $82,000. And by the appellant's own calculation, for the three-month period from October to January, they had an additional $16,641 in income. So unlike the impoverished individual in Hewlin, these people had adequate funds available to make their payment. So the two requirements of the necessity as well as the issue of whether or not they were able to make the payments, I believe our case is absolutely distinguishable from Hewlin. Whereas in Hewlin, you had an individual who just was unfortunate in her circumstances and didn't have the money. In addition to the issue of whether or not there had been payments for the necessities, I think that there are also significant areas factually where Hewlin is going to differ from the facts of our case. And number one is that in Hewlin, the Lynn claimant made the payment directly to the creditor, to the Lynn holder. In our case, we don't have that. We have the appellant making the wire transfer into the account of the appellees, with the appellees then about 3 weeks later making a payment of an unaccelerated mortgage to the lender. I think that's significant because under the theory of equitable subrogation, you are able to step into the shoes of the lien holder. You can't step into a shoe of a lien holder unless you actually pay the lien holder. So I don't think equitable subrogation is proper in this case. In addition, in Hewlin, $80,000 was due and $80,000 was paid. In this case, we have an arbitrary amount of $302,000 being transferred to the account of the appellees, and the appellees paid $201,268, leaving more than $100,000 at their discretion as to how to spend it. I think if we permit a lien to be created in this situation, we're opening the door for fraud in family law cases because anyone is going to have an opportunity that's made a payment to come in and say, I'm entitled to a lien against that homestead. And I think having that opportunity creates an incredible amount of uncertainty in real estate transactions. In this case, we have no idea what the terms were for repayment. Sarah Dees has testimony in the record that says, well, I was told that there was going to be repayment from a railroad personal injury settlement. Dan Dees testifies, oh no, there was supposed to be regular monthly payments of principal and interest. There is no certainty in this type of a situation where we would permit a lien against a homestead. In addition to that, we have in this case a pattern of payments that are being made without any type of repayment. There was one payment of $80,000 in Hewlin, whereas in this case, we have an entire series of payments. We have $167,000 that was paid after the $302,000 payment and after the $15,000 payment. This appellant has deep pockets and engaged in a series of transactions where money was advanced and there was never any type of repayment and there was never any type of a lien that was obtained in exchange for those payments. The appellant in his testimony is an international businessman who does business in the oil and gas area in software development. He has had deep pockets and has been able to make these advances, and it wasn't until after the time of the felony sexual assault charge that a demand had been made. I think that all of these facts are definitely different from those in Hewlin, where you have an individual who is very much in need, whereas we don't see that here. I think that the facts that we see in this case are certainly more in accordance with the Christodoulou case, and I'm sorry for the pronunciation on it. In that case, there was an equitable lien that was placed against a promissory note from a husband to a wife that was to represent the proceeds from a marital homestead. And in that case, the Court of Appeals determined that the equitable lien against that promissory note was going to be inappropriate and in violation of the Texas Constitution. It was an unsecured loan, undocumented, made from the husband's father, who then died, to the husband and wife. And in determining that the lien was not going to be appropriate, the Christodoulou court went on to reiterate that laws protecting a homestead against foreclosure or the payment of debt must be liberally construed. And I think that we need to liberally construe the Constitution in this case and not permit a lien to be placed against a homestead when there is no documentation and when it's not in accordance with the Hewlin case. In closing, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that this case is not in accordance with Hewlin and there is no authority for extending the provisions of Hewlin in opposition to the Texas Constitution where there's only five enumerated points where a lien may be placed and this does not fall within those 5 points.
Reverend, I have another question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know that you're here in representation of Ms. Sarah Dees. Mr. David Dees does not have an attorney representing him in this, and as regards this appeal, you're aware of that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in terms of the trial, there was a statement in open court when Mr. Lane, who was then representing Mr. David Dees, made a statement to the court on page 198 of the trial of the record. Your Honor will proffer to the court now in open court that whatever is hypothetically awarded to Mr. David Dees, he's going to assign that in some way or another to his brother, so we will offer that up in open court. And the judgment allows that Mr. Handy's appointed receiver, he's supposed to sell the property, and then he's supposed to divide the proceeds up, and is given direction in the judgment to pay the proceeds in trust accounts for two of the lawyers who were involved in the trial. Do you have a position as to whether or not the stipulation would afford a proper transfer of the money that is in the judgment supposed to go to Mr. David Dees to be awarded to his brother instead?
Your Honor, while not having previously considered that issue, my understanding was that the split on the proceeds were 65.
And that's what it says in the judgment. And I'm talking about the 35% that's supposed to go to Mr. David Dees. And with the stipulation in open court that that's to go to his brother, I wonder if that stipulation shouldn't control what's in the judgment.
Your Honor, perhaps I understand before your question, I had a minimal amount of time.
Perhaps you're okay. Well, I'm asking you questions. You can go ahead and answer.
Okay. I was going to say perhaps I could.
Very nice of you to be concerned about that.
I was going to perhaps reserve that for until after.
All right,
Mr.
that's fine if you'd like to. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Fishman, we'll give you a little more time, too, since I asked her question. Yes, sir.
The rebuttal gives us a wonderful opportunity to make some points to you. And one of the challenges that was before Judge Catterton was what to do, how to be fair to all the people, and how to be fair in terms of what they've agreed to, what they were trying to do. And the divorce decree is something that's it's a good thing for this family. But in response to your first question to me, as in Hewlin versus Hamilton, unlike the case Krista DeLoe, there is documentation, Flagstar Bank. We've got the first lien, the home finance, refinanced, the deeds of trust are there. Those are simply being assigned to David Dees by virtue of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. So the homestead character of the property, the Texas homestead law of the Constitution, is protected and preserved because it's the Flagstar Bank loan that this court is granting the equitable subrogation benefits to. Regarding the point that there are elements of unjust enrichment, we're only seeking the imposition of a lien on the house to the extent that money was used to pay off the mortgage, 2010 taxes, and home improvements. In that 90-day period, they spent the whole $300,000 collectively. And so had they made the payments to us, the $2,300 a month payment, that would have been okay. They didn't. And since that time, it totals almost $92,000 since October 2010, they've not had to make a monthly payment. So all the benefits have been received, acknowledged, enjoyed by both sides. There's no jeopardy, no imposition.
But doesn't there still have to be a showing that this was a necessity to pay this mortgage off? And Judge Catterton found that it was not, correct?
You're correct, Your Honor. When Judge Catterton's findings of facts and conclusion of law, we brought on this limited appeal, and it's necessities, and as this court held in Tedder, as this court held in Hewlin versus Hamilton, it's this exact point was addressed. Homestead was exactly addressed in Hewlin versus Hamilton, that the money was used to pay off the mortgage. The money was used by both sides, and it would be unjust not to have that money repaid.
Okay, but you're jumping over the necessity issue by saying, well, whether it was or wasn't, it's still unjust enrichment. Okay, let's just say I give you unjust enrichment. Let's go back to necessity. In Hewlin, you had someone who was $80,000 behind on their mortgage and $80,000 was paid. In our case, you have, as I understand it, they weren't behind on the mortgage at all. The note was not accelerated. And they just decided, we have all this money, we'll pay our mortgage off. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So So how is that a necessity?
It's not the necessity that invokes the equitable jurisdiction of the court. It's the concept of necessaries. And is home and transportation and in tether legal fees, are those necessaries? If those are necessaries, then that removes from the problem of whether or not payment is made voluntary or involuntary. And so to say that Dandy's is a volunteer because his money was used to pay off a mortgage that was not in default is not what the doctrine is about. The doctrine is about, was that money used for necessities and for necessaries. That's the term that's used in Hewlin versus Hamilton. That's the term used by this court in Tedder. And that's the term that the Supreme Court is using in determining what is a necessary. And that's a question of fact. And to this point in time, in the reply brief and in trial, there is nothing brought to you that says Dandy's acted inequitably. Nothing that says he acted inequitably. It's clear that the money was used to pay off the mortgage and that a house payment is a necessary. That's a question of fact.
So the standard that we look at to decide whether Judge Catterton was wrong in determining, in his opinion, that it was not, is what, in your opinion?
As you held in Tarrant County versus Denton, the trial court's finding of fact are reviewable for legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence to support them by the same standards that are applied in reviewing evidence supporting a jury's answer at page 168. And that's the standard by which you review this appeal to determine whether or not there is any support for the finding that Dan Dees is a volunteer, that the money was not used for necessaries, and that therefore there's no doctrine of equitable subrogation to be applied. And it's straight out of Hewlin versus Hamilton. So there is authority. It's not abuse of discretion. It's what this court ruled in the Tarrant County case. The first court, the 14th Court of Appeals, Tyler versus Tyler, also cited in our brief, that court held that findings of fact are not conclusive on appeal when the statement of facts appears in the record as it does here. And as Justice Meyer has stated, you have studied the record. Y'all know the record inside out. You know what this case is about. And that's why we've invoked the equitable jurisdiction of the court. We intervened only after the house was being sold by receivership. The motion practice was begun. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both sides for your presentation and your argument here today. And your case is submitted, and you'll hear from the court in due course. Yes, sir, you certainly might. Thank you.